WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're facing a ticking crime bomb, warns my guest, John DiUlio. Most street crimes that frighten us are committed by men under the age of 25. And over the next decade, the number of young men in the population is going to increase substantially. He also warns that we're facing a new breed of young criminal, the super predator. DiUlio elaborates on these thoughts in the new book Body Count, about the war against crime and drugs. It's co-authored with former drug czar and education secretary William Bennett and criminologist John Walters. DiUlio is a professor at Princeton and director of the Brookings Institution Center for Public Management. DiUlio and his co-authors argue that the nation's drug and crime problems are fueled largely by moral poverty. I asked him to explain what they mean by moral poverty.
Essentially, by moral poverty, what we mean is children in need of adults, the problem of kids growing up without even a single adult in their lives, there to care for them, to nurture them, to teach them right from wrong, not a parent, not a coach, not a clergyman, no one. And we think that that factor, more than any other, although there are lots of factors that matter in driving juvenile crime and delinquency and drug use, that factor more than any other explains a lot of the recent increase in juvenile crime.
You say that moral poverty leads to lack of control and lack of empathy.
Right. One of the most disturbing things we see today is not just the total amount of juvenile crime out there, the 2.7 million arrests of juveniles in 1994, up from 1.7 million in 1991, and not just the fact that more of that crime, about 150,000 of those arrests in 1994 for violent crimes, but the remorselessness, the lack of conscience that is associated with some of those juvenile crimes. We think that there are basically two, if you will, character defects that define some of the worst of the worst of today's juvenile criminals. One is their sort of radical present orientation, the inability almost to think of or figure out any relationship between doing something now and being rewarded or punished for it later. And also their, in some cases, near total lack of empathy. They don't look upon other people, in some cases, as human. They don't feel joy at other people's joy or pain at other people's pain. And hence, they're capable, in some cases, of committing the most heinous acts without feeling any pangs of conscience. So that's our worry at the extreme.
So you're describing this problem of children in need of adults as being the problem of moral poverty. But what leads to that? I mean, a lot of people say what leads to that in the first place is hopelessness, long-term poverty, long-term unemployment, a lack of any connection with the larger social issues in America because you're totally cut off economically, socially, where you live. So, I mean,
sure.
Do you see a connection between what you're describing as moral poverty and what other critics describe as
sure.
long-term economic poverty?
Sure. There's a connection. And there are at least a couple of different levels in which we need to understand this. In the first place, Let's not compare. The easy comparison, I think the less interesting and important comparison, is between, say, kids in the suburbs who have parental supervision, go to decent schools, have jobs waiting for them, will probably go to college and are doing pretty well, and kids in the inner cities who have few, if any, of those things. Let's look within the populations, within the most distressed, economically depressed areas of urban America. What we find there, pretty much consistently throughout the empirical literature, as well as the sort of ethnographic field-level, street-level studies, is that even in the case of kids who have every risk factor imaginable flicked on in their lives, they have no adult in the home who's supervising them. They've been abused, neglected, or they've witnessed serious up-close violence. They don't have a decent school. They have little, if any, job prospects. Their lives have been affected, either directly or indirectly, by substance abuse, whether alcohol or illegal drugs. Even among that population of kids, study after study shows that about half the kids are what the academic researchers like to call resilient youth. That is, somehow, some way, half of those kids, even in the most economically depressed circumstances, seem to get to age 18 more or less materially and spiritually whole. Now, the question intellectually and analytically is there anything we can identify in the lives of the kids who made it in those dire circumstances versus in the lives of the kids who didn't, that unlocks the key, that tells us how we might be able to replicate the circumstances of the kids who made it. Based on the research I've done, based on my own street-level experiences, I think there's an answer. And the answer is at the most micro level, that in the lives of the at-risk kids, the severely at-risk kids who made it, you almost always find one adult, could have been a coach, could have been a clergyman, could have been a teacher who stayed after school, could have been the lady around the corner who had three kids of her own and was a single mother but somehow was making it and opened her home, could have been a safe haven that was created by some community organization, that child, that desperately at-risk child, found some adults, one or more adults, who were there for them. So that's so far as I'm concerned, is the silver lining in this cloud.
Now, you say that most street crimes are committed by men under 25 and that, therefore, demographically, America is a ticking time bomb. You say there's a new generation of street criminal, the youngest, biggest, and baddest generation any society has ever seen. You call them super predators. What do you mean by that? And back this up.
Okay. When we talk about the super predators, what we're talking about essentially are the kids who really are at the extreme. Mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier the 2.7 million juvenile crime arrests in 1994. That doesn't mean there are 2.7 million super predators out there, or even that most of those kids, as I said earlier, are even serious or violent or incorrigible in any way. But there is a phenomenon that we see, especially with respect to the development and the proliferation of serious violent street gangs in America, street gangs that now claim over 200,000 members nationwide, where you have more and more kids showing up at police stations, at juvenile lockups, who not only seem to be unconcerned about the crimes for which they've been charged, but seem to have no care either for themselves or for anyone else. We're talking about the kids who are guilty not merely of violence, but of the kind of gratuitous violence, the robbing of the person at the cash register and the senselessly shooting them for absolutely no reason, the drive-by shootings, the kids who do harm almost because, it seems in some cases, almost because they have no regard whatsoever for human life, either their own or anyone else's. Now, it's very hard to be very specific because we don't keep, in terms of the numbers or size of this population. I believe they're there because I've seen them up close and personal in juvenile lockups. I've talked to people, district attorneys around the country. There was recently a summit, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where a number of police officers will tell you much the same thing. People on the street now, inner city clergy, people are seeing these kids. And the so-called super predator is a term that was actually coined by an inmate, an adult inmate, whom I interviewed in a maximum security prison. When I asked a group of these inmates, what explains, in your view, and we're dealing here with a group basically of lifers, mm-hmm. Guys who grew up in the toughest of the tough streets of Newark and Camden, what explains the rise in juvenile violent crime? One of the inmates said, these kids are stone-cold predators. He said, crack killed everybody's mama. These are kids who are coming in here who scare us. They make us nervous and worried. So they're out there. They do not, however, define the entire juvenile crime problem. They define it, however, to the extent that it takes a very small number of such kids on the street, totally antisocial, deviant, delinquent, or criminal, to have a criminogenic impact, if you will, on all the other kids out there. They're the ones who, unless they're attended to, will turn the minnows and the guppies into sand sharks and into great whites. So that's the super predator concern.
Yeah, you say that a lot of people who you describe as the super predators don't see any correlation between committing a crime and getting punished. What would you like to see happen in the juvenile justice system that would reinforce that connection between crime and punishment, that you can't get away with hurting other people?
I think there has to be really a three-pronged strategy. And if you'll forgive the shameless alliteration, I talk about it as monitoring, mentoring, and ministering. The monitoring part is the part the juvenile justice system can do best. When you get a kid who has taken a swing at the teacher but missed and has done some other things, been truant and maybe gotten involved in a few serious fights and maybe was caught with a concealed weapon, say a knife, not a high-tech gun, What we normally do with that kid today is we'll either, if the kid gets probation, he'll be on a caseload with a probation officer who will have many, many more cases that are much more serious and dangerous. So therefore, the minnow, the guppy in his caseload, is not going to get any attention. Yet we also know from the research that that kid, if the kid was hooked up with counseling services, if the kid's behavior was monitored effectively by some adult, that would make a difference. We need, therefore, to create programs like the one we've had running in Philadelphia over the past 10 years called the Youth Aid Panel Program, which involves the community directly in the administration of juvenile justice, where we have three-person panels from the community. Could be a local pastor, a local grocery store person, others who are involved in setting a disposition for a juvenile. The juvenile agrees to the disposition. Could be a curfew. Could be writing an essay on the life and times of a public figure, historical figure. Could be get drug treatment. And that child is therefore spared, under current Pennsylvania law, which is like the law in many states now, a permanent criminal record if he or she completes disposition. We have preliminary data to suggest that 90% of those kids go away and don't come back.
Some experts are saying that the criminal justice system, particularly the juvenile justice system, is racist, that young African-American men are being disproportionately punished, particularly as a result of the war on drugs. What some critics say is that the war on drugs has really been a war on young black men, and that if white middle-class kids were using crack, that they would be given drug rehabilitation programs and education programs and so on. They wouldn't just be thrown in prison, but because the crack epidemic has been mostly among, you know, poor people and many African Americans, that prison is seen as the social solution, and young black men get swept up into this cycle of a system that's just going to toughen them more and then make it even harder to get a job when they get out, mm-hmm. making it even more difficult to become a part of legit society.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
See, I have a there's two levels in which to address that. First of all, I have absolutely no disagreement whatsoever with the view that if children in suburbs and mostly predominantly white suburbs, if where I teach at Princeton University, if we had anything like the level of criminal victimization exposure to juvenile victimizations that we have in, say, Camden, New Jersey, that you'd have a commitment of resources and time and investment and energy that you simply don't see. And that commitment would not just be to more police and to more prisons and to more juvenile facilities or better juvenile probation, but there would be a concentration of minds to find out what's going wrong. I have no qualm with that, nor do I have a qualm with the view, which I think if you're awake and alive and live in this country, you have to be aware that there is a greater degree of police attention, to put it somewhat euphemistically, devoted to young African-American males who may be walking down the streets of Princeton, New Jersey, who will be hassled or stopped more often, other things being equal, by police than their white counterparts. There's in the black community in Philadelphia, sometimes joked about the crime of DWB, driving while black. This happens in America. It's real. It's a part of our legacy. But having said that, the data, and I think there have been studies by the National Academy of Sciences and others, when you look at the behavior of the justice system, once people are brought in, arrested, booked, conviction, post-conviction dispositions, there's really little or no evidence of any systematic racial bias post-1972. Now, the death penalty is a separate issue. But in terms of the adjudication process, there's really very little evidence of systemic and systematic racial disparities in sentencing.
My guest is Princeton professor John DiUlio, co-author of the new book, Body Count. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the war against crime and drugs with John DiUlio, co-author with William Bennett of the new book, Body Count. I want to get back to one of the basic premises of the new book that you co-authored, which is the theory that a lot of crime and a lot of the drug problem in America has to do with moral poverty. When you use the term moral poverty, it sounds like what you're talking about is defects within the individual, as opposed to a larger social, political, economic environment that has put people at an incredible disadvantage and has led to the breakup of the family and has led to poor education and has led to unemployment and hopelessness and a lack of investment in the larger society and so on. Is that what you're saying, that there's some kind of flaw in the individual that is removed from larger social and economic problems?
No,
including
we're saying we're as much antithetically opposed to that position as we can possibly be, because the conception of moral and morality that we employ in the book and that we intend when we use the term moral poverty, to us, you know, there is a school of thought that, without getting us sidetracked into modern political philosophy, that represented by Immanuel Kant and others, where essentially morality and things moral inhere in the individual. But there's an older tradition, a classical tradition, an ancient tradition, which stretches back at least to Aristotle, in which our moral sentiments, our moral sensibilities are shaped by those around us, in particular by our teachers, by our parents. And so we are made moral. So our conception, if anything, it's much closer to the quintessentially mid-century sociology notion of bad boys from bad homes, essentially what we're talking about.
Let me give you an example that I've often heard mentioned by guests on this show. You take a parent who can't get a job at all or doesn't have a job that could pay well enough to support the children and the rent, and ends up turning to selling drugs, turns to the black market instead of the legit market because the black market pays better and there's more opportunity there. There's a job opening in the black market and not in the legit market. So obviously the children are going to be learning lessons about that the crime can pay, that the legit world often doesn't pay or doesn't pay enough. But on the other hand, what has led to that lesson, the lack of opportunity in the legit world? So where does moral poverty fit
in? Well, I take, and I think my co-authors of this book take strong exception to that argument, and for reasons that some of the people who make those sorts of arguments, I think, need to pause and consider or reconsider. When people assume that poverty causes crime, and that kind of poverty, joblessness, hopelessness leads, most poor people, including most poor people living in today's American inner cities, are not criminals, do not commit crimes, and are really are heroes and heroines. They struggle. Most people, under most conditions, struggle to get up in the morning, to find work, to get to school, to run the gauntlet of streets that are often drug and crime infested. These are the heroes and heroines. Even among populations of single-parent families where there's either no work or people are chronically welfare-dependent, you have families that are every bit as much intact and struggling to make it and aspiring. Now, when we excuse, even implicitly excuse, the behavior of people who say, well, I can't make it. It's easier to sell crack to my neighbors and my neighbors' kids than to, you know, struggle with this, to overcome this adversity, to honor whatever religious or spiritual commitments I have. That person's behavior needs to be made. We have to heap moral opprobrium on that person and say, there are no excuses.
One more question about moral poverty. Some critics, I'm sure, would say that the larger moral poverty is our social policies, moral poverty, that we should be cutting poor people off of welfare and saying there's a finite amount of time in your whole life that you can have government assistance that your children can. People would say that's reflective of a larger American moral poverty.
Well, I here have to be very clear that I'm speaking for John DiIulio and not my co-authors in saying that I strongly oppose the notion of welfare time limits. I think it is a mistake on many different levels. In the city of Philadelphia, which is my hometown, the city I know and love best, we have 42% of Pennsylvania's aid to family with dependent children cases. Most of the people on welfare are children. It is in the nature of children to be dependent. The cities, in many cases, simply do not have the tax bases and cannot afford to support these kids. We do not have the jobs. We are losing jobs, not gaining them, especially low-skill jobs. So there is people need to transcend the usual, I think, liberal, conservative, ideological boundaries. We need to recognize that not only is the dependent population concentrated, the kids who will be on welfare in one form or another for 5 years or more before reaching age 18, but even the violent crime here is concentrated in the lives of these dependent youth. It is true, for example, that of the 150,000 juvenile violent arrests that I mentioned earlier in 1994, that would tell you about 0.5% of an entire cohort of juveniles will ever be, you know, getting in trouble for a serious or violent crime. And that'll tell you that most of the serious or violent crime is concentrated in a handful of states or places. Now, the question for this nation, both in terms of welfare policy, social welfare policy, and crime policy is the fact that these problems, the welfare dependency problem, the need for financial support problem, the violent is concentrated, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is that a cause for alarm or complacency? I view it, and here I'm speaking for my co-authors as well, as a cause for alarm. The fact that these problems and these populations are so heavily concentrated in particular places, and the fact that the rest of us can so easily walk away from them, not drive by these places, move to gated communities, hire more rent-a-cops, target hard-and-hour environments, shop at exurbanized shopping malls, this is part of the problem. So I strongly concur with the sentiment that it is wrong to denationalize citizenship anywhere, most especially among where the targets of those policies are at-risk children.
John DiUlio, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John DiUlio is co-author of the book Body Count. He's a professor at Princeton and directs the Brookings Institution Center for Public Management. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.